The benefits of economic growth over the past few decades are undeniable. But is there a point at which growth starts doing more harm than good?
It seems to me that this idea that we can't have infinite growth on a finite planet is rooted in a sort of view of that what matters in driving growth is the tangible world of things, and that's not what drives growth. My name is Daniel Susskind. I'm a research professor at King's College London and a senior research associate at the Institute for Ethics in Artificial Intelligence at Oxford University.
Daniel Susskind is also the author of Growth, A History and a Reckoning, published by Harvard University Press.
Economic growth doesn't come from the tangible world of objects, the things we can see and touch, but it comes from the intangible world of ideas. Ideas about how we can make ever more productive use of the finite resources that we have.
Growth is a concept that lies at the very core of a lot of the work here at the IMF. And while Susskind is also a strong proponent, he believes economic policy should consider more carefully the costs of growth and work to realign the drivers to better fit with the times. You'll find a review of the book in the June issue of Finance and Development magazine. So your new book is not only about the surprisingly short history of economic growth, but of human evolution, really. First of all, what prompted you to write this book, and why go back so far to establish, you know, the benchmark for pre-growth living standards?
I mean, it seems like there are very few things that politicians agree upon today. But one of them is that we need more economic growth. In the UK, for instance, worklessness and poverty are rising, public services are backlogged and broken. Average real wages, which are the best measure of our collective prosperity, basically haven't moved for about 15 years. And so there's a sense that we desperately need more growth. And, you know, as you look around the world, what you see is that almost every country in some form or other slumped their way into the 21st century. So on the one hand, it feels like we desperately need more growth. But if only the problem were as simple as that, because it also appears that growth is associated with almost all the great challenges that we face today as well, whether it's the impact that the pursuit of growth has on the climate, whether it's the growing inequalities in society that have accompanied this extraordinary growth in material prosperity, whether it's technologies like artificial intelligence, which are disrupting work and politics. And then, of course, there's also the loss of local places and communities as well. And so it feels like we face a dilemma, what I call the growth dilemma, that on the one hand, growth has an extraordinary promise that it's associated, in fact, it turns out, and I set this out in the book, with almost every measure of human flourishing. But on the other hand, it's also associated with many of our greatest challenges as well. And it feels like almost every country around the world faces this growth dilemma in some form or other. And so I wanted to write about it, both to make sense of it and also to set out how we ought to respond to it. And the starting point, I think, for trying to make sense of it is exactly, as you say, these sort of the extraordinary history of growth. You know, basically three facts have defined the economic history of human beings until now. I mean, the first is that for almost the entirety of human existence, 300,000 years or so, economic life was essentially stagnant. Whether you were a hunter-gatherer in the Stone Age or a laborer toiling away in the 18th century, although your lives would have differed in lots of respects, fundamentally from an economic point of view, they would have looked remarkably similar. You know, you would have been stuck in a relentless struggle for subsistence. The second fact is that it was only very recently that this stagnation came to an end. You know, modern economic growth began just sort of 200 years ago, you know, growth that was both significant and sustained. And then the final extraordinary fact is that we've managed to maintain this economic ascent. So whenever growth had happened in earlier centuries, it had been limited and quickly fizzled out. But this time it was both significant and sustained. And so I think this sort of context, this kind of deep history the economic lives of human beings for hundreds of thousands of years is really important, just to show how recent and how modern a phenomenon economic growth actually is.
Hmm. And so, as you describe, when growth does kick in, 200 years ago, you talk about how living standards suddenly spike after thousands of years of stagnation. But it's not long into this story before you start describing growth as being, yes, a treasured idea, given all the benefits people are reaping from it, but it's also a dangerous idea. What's dangerous about economic growth?
Yeah, so it's this, and again, it goes to really the heart of the book, which is this tension between the promise of growth and the price of growth. Mm-hmm. The promise of growth, as I said, is that growth is associated with almost every measure of human flourishing. The price is often articulated in environmental terms, a sense that we're growing towards a sort of ecological catastrophe, that the technologies that we rely upon for our material prosperity are dirty carbon dioxide emitting technologies rather than clean technologies. And and climate change is becoming a climate emergency. Mm-hmm. But the argument of the book is that actually the price of growth is broader than that. That it's not simply that these technologies are damaging the environment, but they're also creating large economic inequalities in society. That the pursuit of particular technologies like artificial intelligence, and this is where I've spent a lot of my career until now trying to make sense of the impact of AI on work and society, but there's a sense in which some of the particular technologies that we're developing, some of the most advanced ones, are having an impact on labor markets and on our political institutions it's not clear we can properly control. And then finally, there's also the immense price of growth to local places and communities, and particularly the pursuit of growth through globalization over the last few decades, that while certain industries have flourished, others have fallen into decline, and with them the places and communities that hosted those industries. And work is not only a source of income, but it's also a source of meaning and purpose for many people. And so with the decline of those industries and the decline of those places, you've also seen a decline of shared purpose and community. And so I think there are lots of different dimensions to the price of growth as well. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is find a way to reconcile these two forces. One, the promise, which seems to pull us almost desperately at times towards pursuing more growth. But then on the other hand, this price, which with a sort of equal strength tells us we might need to slow down or do something differently.
Mm-hmm. Just to bring it back a little, you build the story through a lot of history using various characters, some economists, some influential, sometimes controversial economic thinkers of the time to build the story. And John Maynard Keynes appears throughout, which is understandable, given his role in establishing a means to actually measure growth.
That's right. And given my Britishness as well, I have a particular
yes, of course.
A particular fondness for Keynes.
So what prompted Keynes, in the first place, to come up with GDP? And what did that mean for growth as this economic concept?
Yeah. Well, this is another, I think, really interesting thing about growth, which is that before the 1950s, almost no politicians, policymakers, economists, anyone was talking about the idea of pursuing economic growth. For those people living during that long stagnation, those 300,000 years, it would have been, unimaginable. But even if somebody had decided if they wanted to pursue growth in, say, the 1930s or 40s, they wanted to pursue growth as a sort of policy objective, it would have been impossible to do so because there just simply weren't reliable measures of the size of the economy, whether it was growing and if so, by how much. And this is what Keynes experienced in the 1940s at the start of the Second World War. A basic question for a wartime economy is how much of the economic pie can you slice up and dedicate towards the war effort? And Keynes was astonished to find that there weren't reliable measures of the size of the British economy. And so there wasn't a way of telling how much could go to the war effort and how much needed to be retained for civilian needs at home. And so...
He didn't know how much there was to start with.
Because he didn't know how much there was, full stop. Mm-hmm. And so it was the work of Keynes in Britain and Kuznets, Simon Kuznets in the US, that led to the creation of what was first known as gross national product, and then from the 1990s onwards as gross domestic product. So, you know, before Keynes's time, before the sort of 1930s and 40s, there wasn't even a way of reliably measuring the size of the economy. I mean, that doesn't explain, though, where the pursuit of growth as a priority came from, because GDP just gave people a snapshot of how large the economy was at a given moment in time. What made growth such a priority, and, you know, the idea that we ought to relentlessly pursue an increase in GDP over time, was actually a different war, the Cold War. Because what happened in that conflict, of course, wasn't a traditional conflict. There were no sort of grand theaters of war, and there were no traditional metrics of who was winning. You know, soldiers lost, territory gained, military equipment destroyed, and so on. And GDP, in a sense, became a proxy for who was winning that war between the US and the Soviet Union. A sort of period of growthmanship began, where the country that was able to grow their GDP faster appeared to be winning, not only in the sense that they were winning in the sense that, you know, a country with a larger economy would be able to fund a larger military and so would win if any conflict were actually to turn from cold to hot, but also in the sense of we're winning the kind of broader battle of ideas that was underway at the time. You know, the country with a higher GDP was the one that was showing either the market economy or the planned economy was the better way of organizing economic affairs. And what, of course, so terrified policymakers in the US, politicians in the US at the start of the Cold War, was that the numbers that were floating around with respect to growth appeared to suggest that the Soviets were winning.
How interesting that this... you know, relationship between war and and economic growth. So 80 years later, I mean, 80 years after Keynes came up with a way to measure growth, we still live in a world that is very much sold on that growth idea, as you just explained, as the best way to fix and develop economies. And the prescription, you know, in our quest to look for more growth, the prescription is often more investment in capital.
Yes.
How did these ideas become so universally accepted? I mean, especially in institutions like this one that I'm sitting in right now. Why did growth get so much traction?
Why did growth as an idea get so much traction?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think because, you know, it's true that in the beginning, the pursuit of growth, it seems to me, was driven by the sort of necessities of war. But as the demands of war fell away, and other social problems arose, it became very clear that, you know, growth, again, was just responsible for many of our greatest triumphs. It was lifting billions of people out of poverty. You know, richer economies appeared to be far healthier, far better educated. And so it became a way of pursuing those other objectives. It became, one economist described, as the sort of magnetic north for institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. And I think with good reason, because growth is one of our most extraordinary inventions, and the GDP measure, which allowed us to pursue it, you know, similarly, an extraordinary technical accomplishment.
And we can, I guess, credit Keynes as well for selling the idea of growth, you know, at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. And this is when these institutions were formed, but also they were formed on this idea that growth seemed like a good way to sort of deal with the problems of the world.
That's right. And I sort of joke in the book that there were, you know, when economists think about the year 1944, the most important economic meeting is often taken to be exactly as you say, the Bretton Woods Conference, where 44 allied countries come together with a plan for rebuilding the global economic order. And out of it comes two of our most powerful international institutions, the IMF and, of course, what's now known as the World Bank. But the point I make in the book is that actually that's probably not the most consequential meeting that took place that year. You know, the most consequential meeting was probably a far less glamorous one, which took place among 9 economists from statistical offices in the US, UK, and Canada, who, and I couldn't find out exactly where they met, which I think says quite a lot. But my best guess is they met in a sort of nondescript conference center somewhere in Washington, D.C. And, you know, their assignment was pretty modest, which was to agree on a plan to standardize the global approach to national accounting. But essentially what came out of that was an agreement to use a calculation internationally that would eventually become known as GDP. And the IMF and the World Bank, which were conceived in that same year, however powerful they might be, were fundamentally being ruled by that number. Hmm. Again, that sense that it was their magnetic north.
And it's very much the reality of those institutions still today, I think. Yeah. So in this effort to try and, you know, growth as being the thing that everyone wants more of, productivity is tied into that. And the law of diminishing returns is a concept that many of our listeners will understand, that at some point more investment doesn't necessarily pay off. And so this undermines that idea that growth can go on forever with enough investment. But then in the book, you introduce 2 prominent economists who say technology presents a way around diminishing returns.
Yeah. I think it's important just to emphasize that, you know, although politicians and policymakers today talk very confidently about the causes of growth, I think one of the surprises for many people, and I think, you know, what I found very interesting in writing the book is, you know, of course, how little we know about growth, that it remains one of the great mysteries, despite its incredible importance. There's still so much ambiguity. But what I think we can draw, in spite of all this uncertainty and ambiguity that sort of litters the intellectual history of economists thinking about the causes of growth, I think there are 2 lessons which are really very important. The first, exactly as you say, comes from Solow and Swan, the recognition that what drives growth fundamentally is technological progress. And then the second great contribution comes, you know, they're working in the sort of 1950s, comes at the end of the 20th century with Paul Romer and his argument with respect to how it is the discovery of new ideas about the world that drive that technological progress. And this is the sort of key argument that drives the sort of practical part of the book, which is that if we're wanting to answer the question, how do we get more growth? The best answer that we have to that question is that growth comes through technological progress. And in turn, that technological progress comes from new ideas about the world, new ideas for how we use the finite resources at our disposal. And from a distance, that might seem like a relatively simple, relatively anodyne observation. But I think when you apply it in practice, it has some quite important consequences. Important consequences for engaging with some of the critics of growth, and important consequences for thinking about what sort of policies are likely to drive sustained growth in the future.
Mm. Yeah, so Paul Romer, people will know as well from his days as chief economist at the World Bank. Mm. And so, yes, there are many people sold on the idea of infinite growth, but many are not, arguing that increased production is simply an alternative to equitable redistribution, is how you describe it in the book, and worry about what all this growth is doing to the planet, like you talked about at the very beginning of this interview. So, and there's a quote from David Attenborough in the book where he says, "Anyone who believes in indefinite growth on a physically finite planet is either a madman or an economist." So are economists guilty of ignoring the costs?
Yeah. I mean, no. And I think this is one of the most important contributions that economists and economic thought can make to these conversations about growth. I set out earlier in our conversation this sort of growth dilemma, this tension between the promise and the price of growth. And there is a movement which is becoming increasingly influential, known as the degrowth movement,
right,
who argue that the best way to respond to what I've called this growth dilemma is not simply to slow down the growth of the economy or stop it, but actively go into reverse to try and pursue negative GDP growth. And one of the great challenges with degrowth is that it's actually quite tricky to pin down exactly what it is that they're after. But I think there are various dimensions to it. One dimension is a sort of diagnosis of what's wrong with the world. And on this aspect, I think, you know, they are on point, which is that growth has a serious price associated with it.
Right.
If anything, I think the degrowth movement underestimates the price of growth because it focuses only on the environmental dimension. But there's another part to their diagnosis of what's wrong with the world, and it's this idea that continued growth is not only undesirable in some sense, which I'm sympathetic to,
right,
to some degree, but that it's also infeasible as well. And I think this is just, you know, fundamentally wrong. They have a slogan, which is that infinite growth is not possible on a finite planet.
Right.
That sits at the heart of a lot of the arguments that the degrowth movement make. It's what's driving David Attenborough's comment. It's what, you know, activists like Greta Thunberg and politicians like Caroline Lucas in the UK have, it's their sort of the intellectual roots for a lot of their objections to our current economic direction of travel. And I think it's just fundamentally wrong, this idea that infinite growth is not possible on a finite planet. Infinite growth is possible on a finite planet, or effectively infinite growth. And the reason why this confusion is being made is because it is rooted, and this is one of the key arguments of the book, it's rooted in just a misunderstanding about how it is that growth actually works. It relies on a very old-fashioned view, a sort of 18th, 19th century view of economic activity, that what matters in economics is the material world, the things that we can see and touch.
Right.
And you can it's an understandable disposition, you know, that this, when you look at the world that the founding fathers of economics were found themselves in, people like Smith, Mill, Ricardo, Marx, the world around them was overwhelmingly, you know, a tangible world.
Yeah.
You know, farms and factories, people worked with their hands, they used tools and machines, inputs into production could be counted, outputs could be counted, and so on. And it's true that, of course, if all that matters for growth is the material world, the world of tangible objects, then obviously there are limits. You know, there is only so much land that can be plowed, only so much raw material that can be used, only so many people, and so on. But the key observation, and it's rooted in the work of, as I said before, Paul Romer, but others have made it as well, is that economic growth doesn't come from using more and more finite resources. It comes from discovering ever more productive ways of using those finite resources. In other words, growth doesn't come from the tangible world of objects, the things we can see and touch, but it comes from the intangible world of ideas. Ideas about how we can, again, make ever more productive use of the finite resources that we have. And again, the key point here is that whereas that the world of tangible objects is finite, there's only so many things we can, you know, see and touch, the world of ideas is unimaginably vast, as good as infinite. And you know, there's a great example just to really hammer this point home. If you think of a kitchen larder with 300 ingredients in it, you know, well-stocked larder, that, you know, that's a finite set of ingredients. But there are more possible recipes, more ideas for combining those ingredients than there are atoms in the universe. And that's the sort of, and when we're talking about growth, we're not talking about ideas for combining 300 ingredients, but we're talking about ideas for combining literally all the material in the universe.
And I like this example as you were speaking of that, you know, the example of having all the ingredients to make various things in infinite possibilities. I think it was Akerlof that came out saying, you know, we don't necessarily need a chicken flavored ice cream.
Yes. Yes. And his point being that some ideas are bad. And, it's a great point. It's slightly unfortunate that since he made that observation, there has been a chicken-flavored ice cream, but the basic point still stands. But it's sort of, in my view, that observation is kind of blown away by the sort of vastness of the combinatorial possibilities. You know, there are so many ideas out there waiting to be discovered that, yes, you know, there are bad ideas, but there's so many ideas that there's going to be some good ones too.
Mm. And so finally, like so many things, the answer probably lies somewhere in the middle. And so,
yeah.
And you do talk about the trade-offs in the book, near the end of your book, growth versus equality is a big one. So how do we get to that place? I mean, I think you've made the argument throughout this conversation, but is there a way, like a feasible way to get to that place where we continue to benefit from growth without biting the hand that feeds it?
Yeah.
To quote Elvis Costello or whoever came up with it first.
And so this is what the second half of the book is all about. Mm-hmm. And we could have another conversation about only this, about how we do it. I mean, my starting point is that if we did what the degrowth movement said and actively pursue no growth or negative growth, it would just be one of the greatest acts of self-harm that humankind could ever inflict upon itself. It would mean, you know, if we were to freeze global GDP at its current levels, that would mean condemning 800 million people to extreme poverty. Or if you don't like the sound of that, then you're going to have to find a way to slash the incomes of the 7.1 billion people that remain, basically all of the Western world. And it just seems so unimaginative to me to think that our current economic lot is the best that we can ever do, that we've reached some kind of economic peak and that we ought to press pause now, not simply for the next 10 years or 10,000 years, but for all time to come. So my starting point is that we need more growth. And based on this argument that growth comes from technological progress, which in turn comes from discovering ideas about the world, I set out how we can become societies, become economies that place greater primacy on the discovery of ideas. Things like reforming our antiquated intellectual property regime, investing vastly more in research and development, encouraging more people into the parts of the economy that are responsible for generating ideas, and finally using technology itself to help us generate ideas. And I spend lots of time in the book looking at exactly what these policy ideas mean in practice. But I think the key thing then is, though, that it's not enough simply to pursue more growth. If we were to do just that, it would be to repeat the mistakes of the past. We can't simply plow on and ignore the enormous price as well. And so I then go on to explain how we can use every tool at our disposal to change the nature of growth that we enjoy, to try and encourage society to develop technologies that not only promote growth, but also protect the environment, narrow inequalities, you know, don't disrupt our work and politics, don't dislocate local places and communities. And again, I go through each of the different dimensions of the price of growth and explain how we can use these tools to try and transform the incentives that exist currently in the market in a direction that respects these other things that we care about. And that's how I see a way out of this growth dilemma, by redirecting technological progress.
So the thesis is, even though all these challenges seem so monumental, growth is actually the tool that we can use to fix it if we do it right.
And at a deeper level, the particular technologies that we develop are the sort of tool that we can use to get it right. You know, there's often a sense, I think, that growth, it's almost like policymakers are sort of drivers on a train, and the only tool that they have at their disposal is to sort of speed up or slow down. But the basic sort of direction of economic travel is set by the rails that, you know, are laid down for them to trundle along. And I say, no, that's the wrong metaphor.
They need to change their means of transportation.
Yeah, we need to instead think that we're on a boat and we can change not simply our speed of travel, but also our direction as well. And we do that by changing the incentives that people face in society, and in turn, changing the sorts of technologies that we develop.
Daniel Siskind, it's a wonderful book, a great read. So congratulations. And it's also a very timely book. So it's been a real pleasure talking with you about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me again. Real pleasure to be with you.
Daniel Siskind's latest book, Growth, A History and a Reckoning, is published by Harvard University Press and is reviewed in the June issue of Finance and Development magazine. Check it out at imf.org/FND. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, which used to be Twitter, @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.